Welcome everyone to the Bitcoin Well podcast. Today we're doing something a little different. This is actually a rebroadcast of our first ever Bitcoin Well Spaces. I sat down with Robert Rios, aka the Peruvian Bull, or Mr. Bull, and Robert from Infernomics to dig into one of the most talked about stories in crypto right now, the Jane Street allegations and what they mean for Bitcoin. We covered the Terraform Labs lawsuit, the suspicious 10 a.m. slam traders have been watching for months, and why the current macro environment is actually setting up for one of the most compelling long-term cases for Bitcoin that we've ever seen. If you've been feeling shaken by the price action lately, this conversation will remind you exactly why you're here. So let's jump on in. Welcome to the first ever Bitcoin Well Spaces. I'm Zach of Bitcoin Well, and today I'm joined by Robert Rios, aka the Peruvian Bull. He's going to be the primary MC of today's show because he's graciously offered to take me under his wing as I learn the ropes of spaces, which we just dealt with some glitches there, but I think we figured it out as I try not to break anything else. Today we're going to be primarily talking about Jane Street and their potential manipulation of the Bitcoin market. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and pass it over. Do you prefer Mr. Bull, Peruvian?
Yeah, no. Either one works. I used to be anonymous for many years, and so I'm used to people calling me PB or Peruvian Bull still. But anything works fine. I also brought my Scottish friend, Mr. Robert Infernomics, up here. So I'm excited to chat because I'm sure you have some insights on Bitcoin and macro that we can discuss today.
Awesome. Welcome, Robert.
Robert, thanks, are you?
Guys. Yeah. Hey, good to be here.
Hey, thanks for coming on. I wanted to talk about, the things that have happened this week, because this has been a pretty, pretty crazy week, especially for Bitcoin. We obviously had the news drop on the 23rd that Terraform Lab, or the bankruptcy proceeding for Terraform Labs, the person running the lawsuit was has filed an injunction against several members of Jane Street, and in that lawsuit, he's alleging that Jane Street essentially had inside information onto the collapse of Terraform Labs and UST. In May of 2022, which eventually obviously led to the collapse of Three Arrows Capital, FTX, right? Celsius. It kind of was that entire crypto winter catalyst. And so I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the nature of Bitcoin. There's a ton of stuff going around. There's a ton of conspiracy theories, wild speculation going on. So
sounds great.
Yeah. But yeah, so I'll take everyone through like a quick synopsis of what happened. And of course, like Infernomics, if you want to jump in and add any like insights on Bitcoin specifically, you can. So basically, back in 2022, I'll even start the story a little earlier. So in September of 2021, this guy, Bryce Snyder, who was an intern at Terraform Labs, left the company and went to go work for Jane Street as a trader. And while he was working for Jane Street, So he was working for Jane Street up until September 2021. Then he went to go work at Terraform Labs. And while he was working at Terraform Labs, he created a group chat with a software engineer and the head of business development at Terraform Labs. And he started collecting what it seems like, what the lawsuit's alleging, and they have, obviously documents and chat data to prove this. He was basically collecting information on how Terraform Labs operated and how their Lunaterra stablecoin and their actual non-depegged coin operated, and feeding that information back to Jane Street. And in the lawsuit, they basically point out that, as an example, May 7th, 2022, Terraform Labs had withdrawn 150 million UST from Curve 3 pool, which is one of the biggest decentralized liquidity pools. And just 10 minutes later, Jane Street also withdrew an additional 85 million UST from that pool. And that transaction that Terraform Labs did, that 150 million withdrawal, was not publicly announced. So it was something that Jane Street should not have been privy to. And yet they were able to essentially copy trade another large player in the market, and front run retail liquidity. And of course, as we know, as in the next few days in May of 2022, Terraform Labs started to come under intense liquidity concerns. Terra Luna, the stablecoin UST, started to depeg, and then it eventually hyperinflated due to the, feedback loop, the recursive feedback loop that existed within their ecosystem. And the entire entire Terraform Labs platform and their stablecoins and their just normal crypto coin was wiped out, and $40 billion of value was destroyed. And obviously, Do Kwon has been sued. I believe he was sentenced in December 2025 to like 15 years in prison. But as soon as this news came out, right, Bitcoin started rallying, and we didn't have that 10 a.m. slam that traders have been watching for months. And so a lot of people have been speculating like this was the main thing driving Bitcoin down, was simply Jane Street using a similar playbook that they use on Terra Luna on Bitcoin itself, which on the surface, it could make sense, right? I think that there's definitely some validity to that theory, especially since they are the one of the authorized participants for IBIT, which is the main Bitcoin ETF that's created by BlackRock. But yeah, we can get into that a little later, but just wanted to kind of lay the groundwork for where we're going.
Well, I kind of have a foundational question real quick, because like, I am not super into the macro or like the larger financial stuff. Like I'm just like, Bitcoin's hard money, buy Bitcoin, don't play like fiat games or Wall Street games. How do we like, from my point of view, I just kind of assume there's so much scamming and BS going on in the market. How do we know that, like, or why do we think maybe that these guys had such a big influence, like, versus somebody else out there playing all sorts of, market games out there?
Sure. So it's for several reasons. I mean, for one, Jane Street is literally the most profitable trading firm on Wall Street. In 2025, their Q2 earnings were $10 billion, which was the highest on record of any quantitative firm on Wall Street. Their total earnings for the year were, I think, $20 billion. And they've given out, in 2025, they gave out $2 billion in compensation. They manage like $660 billion or so in assets. And like I said, they're kind of they're an interesting firm because they're a non-traditional Wall Street firm, right? They are employee owned. They don't have a centralized CEO or C-suite that most companies have. And they kind of have decentralized, like a decentralized leadership structure, which makes it difficult because if you're if you're a prosecutor, if you're a DA, you're trying to go after these guys, like, who's actually responsible? You don't really know who's calling the shots within the company. Because even the guy who, one of the people founded it, Rob Granieri, is basically out of the spotlight. He claims that he makes barely any real world and day-to-day decisions in the firm. And he is basically not allowed to have, not allowed his profile to come up in the public spotlight at all. And so, Jane Street has kind of been this like quiet, underhanded, like stealthy firm on Wall Street that's been growing steadily since their inception in 1999. But they have been accused multiple times of market manipulation, of insider trading, of things like that. I mean, they were banned from India's stock market, I believe last year, due to their manipulation of the Nifty 50 index. And so, you know, if that's any indication of what these people are, like, I don't think it's that big of a stretch to think that they would be doing a similar playbook on IBIT and on Bitcoin itself, especially because they can play a lot of games with their status as an authorized participant.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And they're like a fascinating group. Like, I was doing some research, and they're almost like the anti like Bitcoin philosophy. Like, it uses a lot of similar wording to like Bitcoin. Like, they use math, like they're very math focused. Like, they have this like equation of expected value that they use that just like calculate. It doesn't matter if something fails a lot, as long as we can calculate that it's going to succeed enough that we make a profit, we do it. And they're like really connected to that effective altruism group that I know that like Sam Bankman-Fried, I think he even came from Jane Street, if I'm not.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Him and Caroline Ellison.
Both of them came from there and kind of took that effective altruism philosophy to mean they could do anything as long as it was quote unquote, you know, for the good at the end of the day, even if it was wrong. It's kind of interesting because they claim to be very libertarianism while also like donating a lot to political parties and things like that. So it's got a lot of the markings of something that sounds good on the surface, but then the more you look into it, there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's, you know, that 10 a.m. slam thing has been, I'm not sure if Robert, you're familiar with the 10 a.m. slam, but it's something that like traders have seen for the last, you know, 3 or 4 months pretty regularly. You know, Bitcoin just getting slammed in the open and then slowly trading back up throughout the day. And regular action like that was seen also in the gold market. I read one report, this was a couple of years ago, but one fund manager had gotten frustrated with, you know, the lack of price action in gold. And so we hired a statistician to go back and look at the trading action of gold futures for the last 30 years. And they basically found it was like a 99th, it was in the 99th percentile of probability, because they had seen price slams in the same fashion in the morning, and then price slams as well during midday at almost like mechanical intervals, right? Like 1 p.m., 3 p.m., 5 p.m., exact same times. And the probability was, you know, next to zero that could have happened as a natural market event. And so it was hypothesized that there were some major players doing that. And again, that was a conspiracy theory from like 10 years ago. But I think as we're seeing more and more, like these conspiracy theories are actually playing out. Now, as for Bitcoin, where Bitcoin goes from here, I think we're in an interesting market environment, and I'm sure market or Infernomics can chat more about this as well. But you know, we're kind of in a waiting period, right? I call it like the doldrums, because you know, we haven't had a new Federal Reserve chairman yet. That's going to happen in late April, early May. The Fed has committed to doing this kind of quasi stealth QE, kind of not QE, with their bill purchases. And they haven't signaled like a huge amount of rate cuts for the rest of 2026. So until we see further improvement in macro liquidity conditions, and especially until we see the long-term hodlers stop selling, because that's been one of the major headwinds for Bitcoin, is if you look at Checkmate, you look at Glassnode, you know, long-term holders have been selling at record pace. I think it was like $4 to $6 billion a day of sell pressure from addresses holding Bitcoin for 12 months or more. So until we exhaust those sellers, I think even though we might grind a bit higher back to 70K, I think we're going to be waiting for the bull market to restart.
Yeah, it's a pretty challenging condition right now for Bitcoin. I'm not selling my Bitcoin, but I'm also hedging. I just finally bit the bullet and got my TLT calls. I think, you know, you talk about liquidity. RMP started, that's the QE, not QE, where the Fed is printing bank reserves, using those freshly printed dollars to buy treasury bills. This is what makes it different from QE, is that it's short-dated U.S. treasuries. That's due to the issues we saw in the repo market, Q2, Q3, Q4 of last year, where SOFR spreads were starting to widen and starting to get some dislocation there. The issue there is that's where the basis trade is financed, and the basis trade is 100-to-1 levered hedge fund trade, popular hedge fund trade. That basis trade is responsible for absorbing about 40% of all new U.S. Treasury issuance. So you remove the basis trade and half of the demand for U.S. Treasuries goes out the window. And that's according to the Federal Reserve themselves. So yeah, they can't let the repo market have too much dysfunction. That's why they started the RMPs. I think that there's, you know, it's very likely that they even increase the amount of those RMPs. If there's, you know, any hiccup in the repo market, I think that could very well go higher from about, you know, 50 billion, maybe to 70 or 80, something like that. It's a systemic risk there. Unfortunately, the basis trade has blown up multiple times. So it's a well-known risk. They can't let that happen. So on the one hand, you have liquidity from the Fed that is positive, which generally, like, that's supportive of an asset like Bitcoin. But if you look at like M2 in the broad money and M2, that's actually starting to roll over. It's actually been rolling over. If you look at the rate of change of M2, that's actually started to slow quite noticeably since Q2, Q3 of last year. And that coincides a bit, at least recently, with a flatter yield curve, you know, and some of the kind of broader concerns with respect to AI and potential deflationary impact from AI. You know, obviously, it's likely to cause some disruption, at least in the labor market. So yeah, there's definitely some negative growth shocks that are starting to kind of ripple through. You look at, you know, rates basically down all across the yield curve over the past month or so. Stocks have been, you know, quite choppy, and a lot of rotation under the surface, a lot of dispersion, volatility has been rising. So there's definitely like kind of tension building. And I think that it probably resolves, unfortunately for Bitcoin, to the downside.
What do you think changes the stasis that we're in, Robert?
I'm not sure. I think that private credit could, that's one risk I didn't really mention, but that's another huge risk right now when it comes to the downside. I think that you could also get further, you know, kind of mass layoff announcements from big major companies. Block, you know, maybe you're able to look through that a little bit, given the kind of, you know, they're down 80% over the past 2 years or whatever it is, right? And you can make all sorts of excuses there. Oh, they're fintech, they're relatively small, you know, they're down, the stock price is down, you know, big over the past year or two. So maybe, you know, the market is able to look through that a little bit. I would argue that announcement yesterday was actually pretty major. But, you know, if you get continued announcements like that, that would definitely break it for Bitcoin. Remember, you know, Bitcoin's never really seen a actual full-blown recession. So, you know, I really like Bitcoin, 60-ish percent long Bitcoin. And so, you know, I don't want it to go down. But if we do enter a true credit contraction, credit event, you know, growth scare sort of environment, recession, God forbid, I think Bitcoin goes like substantially lower, like maybe four digits, which would be quite painful. But, you know, I think the bullish news here is that if you're willing to look through the short-term volatility, you know, Bitcoin, the most bullish thing for Bitcoin is a recession. So, you know, initially the stasis that we're in right now would break to the downside. But like, if you have a 10-year, you know, a 5-year, 10-year, 15-year time horizon, you know, the way that Bitcoin gets to 1 million or 2 million is a recession, because in a recession, by definition, the deficit goes up due to expenditures rising about 12% on average and revenue going down by about 25%. So you're talking about a $5 trillion deficit if we go into a recession. You know, that's 15, 16% of US GDP. There's no way the Fed doesn't come in and directly monetize that, aka print money to buy US treasuries. There's also no way that they don't backstop private credit. There's also no way that they don't, you know, we're already having lawmakers propose UBI, bills, right, with respect to AI. So, you know, UBI would have to be funded. I mean, you're talking about money printing that would make 2020 look like child's play. I mean, it would barely show up on the M2 chart or the M0 chart. So if you have a long enough time horizon, low time preference, like I do with respect to my Bitcoin, you know, I'm not really super worried. I'm trying to hedge a little bit and like try to make money on this view that I have. But, you know, with my Bitcoin, I'm not selling or anything like that.
Yeah, no, I'm in the same camp. And I think, you know, what you said is extremely, extremely poignant, right? Because we're already sitting at a fiscal spot where, you know, we have $2 trillion deficits annually. Overall interest expenses in excess of $1 trillion. It's growing, you know, 15, 20% a year compounded. It's now, I think, the second largest line item after Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, if you lump all those together. We have $38 trillion of debt, right? And so if we enter any sort of fiscal crisis, whether that be a recession or another war or some sort of like, you know, horrific natural disaster, and fiscal spending needs to grow, you know, who's going to finance that, right? And the Fed does have, you know, they do have some more tools in their toolboxes than most people realize, right? We kind of thought before, I'd say 2020, that the only way that you could deal with, you know, manage a fiscal crisis would be to do QE or to run a, you know, a Japan playbook and do yield curve control or do QQE or some sort of, you know, financial stimulus via the monetary, sector, like the central bank. But they have shown an ability to adapt and to create new sources of funding, right? In 2013, they created the money market fund regulations that forced a lot of money market funds to invest a super majority, right? Like 99% of their assets into T-bills, especially short-term dated debt. And that added, obviously, trillions of dollars of new demand for T-bills. They also made changes to Basel III, to a lot of the liquidity ratios, right? The SLR, to force banks to load up on treasuries such that banks now hold, you know, several trillion dollars worth of treasuries, and that and their capacity to hold treasuries is going to increase, especially after the, I think it was late November announcement from the Fed that they're lowering the SLR buffer ratio. So that basically means that banks can hold the same amount of treasuries with less capital in reserve against them, which allows them to free up more capital on their balance sheet to either buy more treasuries or to, you know, do other forms of trading or investment or, you know, liquidity concerns. So overall, I think, you know, whether that be outright QE and like bill purchases and this like quasi not QE program that they've started in December, or if that's, you know, essentially forcing the banks to swallow up more debt or forcing money market funds or pension funds to, you know, on wholesale buy up US debt. I think more, you know, monetization of the debt is coming. And so the question is just like, what's the form that's going to take? And obviously some forms are more stimulative and some are less so.
Yeah. Question and also, about that.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Real quick, Robert, because you were talking about new tools in their playbook. How much is stablecoins a new tool that they're going to use to sort of lessen the effects of inflation and get more users for the dollar? Is that on the same level as the other stuff you were just mentioning, or is that a different area entirely?
So I've done some research on stablecoins because they're, you know, they're obviously very interesting. They're kind of like a euro dollar-esque system, but on crypto rails that allows the US dollar to be you know, adopted worldwide by people in the third mm-hmm. world and in the global south. But I think the, you know, the idea that Bessent had and other people, even within the Trump administration, had that stablecoins could save the U.S. fiscal situation is kind of misguided. If you look at the numbers, even the most aggressive estimates show that stablecoins could add between $1 to $2 trillion of short-term demand for U.S. Treasury bills in the next, you know, 5 to 7 years. And in that time, U.S. Treasury debt's going to inflate by, you know, well over $12 trillion. So,
yeah,
the idea that that's going to actually, and that's the most optimistic scenario, right? The more realistic scenario is like a couple hundred billion. And so, you know, 300, 400 billion in new demand for just ultra short-term debt, that's not going to change the fiscal picture of, you know, $38 trillion of total debt. And this year alone, they're issuing $10 trillion of T-bills. So
yeah, just like just in a single auction, they will auction off $105 billion in a single day, in a single maturity. So a single tenor, you'll see $105, $110 billion auction. So yeah, just like the real question with stablecoins is net new demand, not money shifting from one pocket to another, but how much actual net new demand is going to flow into T-bills. And yeah, I from what I've read and what I've found, it's probably closer to 200, 300 billion, maybe 400 billion at the most. But yeah, the kind of hyper bullish expectations of, oh, it's going to add, you know, $3 trillion. I think you should fade that.
Did you have any other question? I thought you were going to ask something else as well.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Okay. But yeah, so anyways, like that's the problem with a lot of these forecasts is like they sound extremely optimistic on the surface, right? And they sound like extremely promising that they can do these things to save us from the fiscal catastrophe that basically has been brought upon us by the politicians and Congress. But the reality is like it's like the Bitcoiners say, right? You can't outcompete the math, right? You can't ignore the math. It's inevitable, right? And so the longer this goes on, and the longer you know we allow you know the economy to run at in a deficit in terms of fiscal spending, and we allow inflation to be above the 2% target, and we allow overall productivity to surge while wages, or you could say like overall hours worked, drops because of AI, the worse the fiscal situation gets, you know. And so Block's announcement on, was that Tuesday or Wednesday, to cut 40% of their staff, you know, that's just the beginning, I think. And that's a problem because a large part of the US tax base is essentially a tax on time, right? Payroll taxes, income taxes, Social Security. If people work less hours or work for less money, then they incur less tax liabilities, and therefore the government receives less revenue. And then at the same time, you also have government that is being asked to potentially, especially by people on the left, to enact some form of UBI or some form of, you know, grand society programs or great society programs on an expanded scale that we haven't seen, you know, since something like World War II. And so if we're going to do that while we're already at, you know, $5-6 trillion in spending already, I think the deficit picture is just going to get extremely bad. And that's when Bitcoin and gold and silver can really shine, right? When those negative economic events happen, I think people holding Bitcoin will start to see the reason, because right now, obviously, it's down and there's a lot of bears in the timeline just screaming about how everything is over for the orange coin.
Well, that's always the best time to buy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's funny too, because like this, I mean, this happens every cycle. Like
it's always the worst. Every cycle is the worst.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even make it up. Like that, I've seen people that I saw back in 2020, you know, who were screaming on Twitter about how Bitcoin's dead and like no one uses it and adoption's going out the window and short it while you can, get out, it's going to zero. They're doing the same thing again at 66,000, right? And you just have to continually send them screenshots of their own tweets from 4 or 5 years ago, and they still don't get it. they still want to be bearish on the timeline. But you know, that's their choice, right?
Well, it seems like a lot of giant cycles. It's like everything just repeats. Like looking in the notes, I know you were going to talk about gold at some point, but I mean, this goes back. I was just doing educational videos about the history of money and gold. I mean, what they're doing today is just like hyper versions of what they did in the past when gold got replaced by dollar gold, by paper gold, and they started playing games with that and inflating the currency. It's like fast forward to now, it's just layers on top of layers on top of layers. It's nothing new. They just keep creating new ways to inflate the money supply and play games with that money to inflate it more for them. That hurts everyone else who's not playing those games. It amazes me that we have something like Bitcoin that can't be faked. It's just a lot of people don't fully understand that, and they're still playing games with the Bitcoin too. There's tons of paper Bitcoin out there because people aren't self-custodying it. So, I mean, to me, that's the most important thing in times like this, is just educate people on how to actually own their Bitcoin, because there's no better chance to actually outgrow this system than to have a hard currency that people understand, and they can't play the games with it if you hold your own Bitcoin, you know?
Yeah. Not only the scarcity element of Bitcoin either, but like the ability to, I mean, I know this is kind of dark, but in the world that I see over the next 10 years, 15 years, the amount of like political polarization, political division, potentially oh, yeah. even racial issues, you're going to probably have like the tech singularity people versus more of a kind of neo-Luddite type approach to data centers and tech. Like all of this instability and volatility on a social level, I think that the ability to memorize 12 words and be able to cross state lines, cross, you know, if you, God forbid, we have to flee the country, you know, you can memorize 12 words and take that with you anywhere. No one has a clue. So I think that element of Bitcoin too, scarcity is obviously like one of the primary benefits that I think a lot of people talk about a lot. But just because we have stability politically, socially, relatively, I mean, I would argue it's deteriorating, but just because we have kind of a relatively together society today does not mean that, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that it's not going to be, much, much darker, much worse. And that property of Bitcoin, I think, might shine even more than the scarcity, or they might shine together.
That's actually a good point. Definitely. Yeah, that's a good point. And I was also going to add, and actually maybe this is a good thread we could pull on for this spaces, is, AI is able to essentially, you know, drive the cost, the marginal cost of software and the marginal cost of compute, especially for complex tasks, down to zero, right? So the value proposition that most firms in the, you know, the tech boom had, which was a monopoly on high level systems thinking, complex code bases, ability to organize and present information, that monopoly is disappearing, right? But Bitcoin operates on, you know, proof of work and energy, and AI can do a lot of things, but it can't create energy out of thin air, right? It can't create physical real world things, at least not yet. And so until we reach some sort of like ubiquitous free energy society, and even then Bitcoin will still be secured, obviously, because of the network, and the hash rate would be, you know, exponentially larger than it is now. But in the interim, Bitcoin's not really affected in a negative way by AI, because it's not going to erode the fundamental value proposition.
Yeah, and I heard actually our CEO made a really good argument for a positive side of AI that I didn't consider. But, you know, it seems really bad with companies cutting like half their employees. But the other side of it is that AI allows people to start up businesses much easier and to be much leaner in their business. So and theoretically, there could be a world in the not so distant future where there's way more companies, way more competition, which could drive prices down and actually, you know, help the economy overall.
Well, that's the
natural. In the Citadel piece that tried to kind of take down or counter Citrini's piece, in the Citadel article, they that was one of the charts they showed, was new business applications were like, you know, up and to the right in a parabolic fashion. So I know for me, it's helped me, you know, I don't rely on it, you know, I don't use it like heavily, but it has helped me kind of augment, you know, what I do with, you know, my YouTube and that kind of thing.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. It's insane. The other week I vibe coded an app using Claude Code, to scrape the YouTube API and find outlier YouTube videos in the finance niche. and email them to me every morning. And I built the entire thing in like 6 days. And I already have the backend running on Railway. I have a Postgres database. I have the front end on Lovable. And I have all the code posted to GitHub. And again, I'm someone with literally 3 months of coding experience that took like a course I took back in 2021. So I'm by no means an expert. If anything, I'm a novice when it comes to this stuff. And yet I can code up an entire app within 6 days, 7 days. And so people who are actually experienced with, you know, even with a small degree or a low degree of software engineering experience, they'll be able to build entire companies. One of the things that they said in that Citrini piece was, you know, there was the CIO of a Fortune 500 company that was looking at a $500,000 a year software renewal. And he was on the call with the sales rep from the company, and they were asking him, you know, hey, we're going to do a 5% increase. Is that all right? And he said, look, like, your product is nice, but we've been talking to, you know, some of our engineers who use ChatGPT. And with a pro subscription, they can rebuild your entire product in a month. And so why do we need to pay you when we can just hire five or six, we can just spend five or six, have five or six of our own guys spend their time for a month or two and build this entire thing, you know, internally. And so the sales rep panicked and obviously renewed for a lower price, but that's, you know, that's what's going to happen. All the legacy software companies, IBM, right, Cloudflare, Okta, all of them are at risk. And I think, you know, Claude especially is one of the, you know, leading models. They're going to be going after essentially all the incumbents in the tech space, right? Last Friday was all the cybersecurity companies, you know, Cloudflare and Okta. And then obviously this week was IBM. And who knows who they'll go after next week. But the barrier to entry to creating a tech company, the amount of money you need to raise, the amount of technical knowledge you need to have, the amount of time you need to spend, all of that is going to fall exponentially. And I think we're going to see almost like a new golden age of bootstrap founders, but it still doesn't fix the problem of the employment picture, at least in the medium term.
Yeah. And it's important to remember that, you know, in the US at least, when you look at the composition of GDP, and I understand, like, I am not a GDP maximalist, that, you know, a big number gets bigger. I don't really care if it doesn't benefit the average American, but from purely a quantitative standpoint, you know, purely objectively speaking, when you look at GDP, about 2/3 of that is consumer spending. So who is spending? Who is doing that 2/3 of consumer spending? Well, once you look at the consumer spending, about half of it is being done by the top 10% of income earners. Well, the top 10% of income earners own 93% of US household equity exposure. So you get a decline in the stock market due to what Roberto was just describing with the equity market pricing in and trying to discount some of this future disruption to cash flow and revenue, that, you know, you can get into a reflexive, vicious cycle where, you know, stock market declines fuel less negative wealth effect, right? The very thing that has been powering that top 10% to spend into the economy, the very thing, which is the booming stock market. Well, if that stock market is no longer booming, that wealth effect, instead of being a positive contribution, goes around and flips to a negative contribution. And now remember that they account for half of consumer spending. You know, very quickly, you can see how that becomes kind of a vicious cycle that feeds on itself. And lower consumer spending, obviously, is, you know, lower revenue, and so on and so forth. So it can really kind of turn on us quite quickly here. And I think that the labor market, remember, you know, these people, we can call them white collar, and we can call them, you know, useless spreadsheet jobs and whatever we can use all those terms, and, you know, agree or disagree whether or not, they're super helpful to kind of broader society. But they have a mortgage, they have a car note, they go on vacation. I mean, airline stocks were down pretty large today, and the cruise companies as well. So, you know, they go on vacation, they have a car note, they have a mortgage, they have a grocery bill, right? So very quickly, this is how kind of those sort of things feed on themselves, and can, you know, one kind of ripple can turn into a kind of a larger credit contraction.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that's I think, you know, obviously there's some upsides, there's some huge upsides to AI, but you know, this reorganization, right? This reordering of society is something that's gonna take time to play out, but it's kind of terrifying the pace of development, right? Opus 4.6 was just released a few weeks ago. And you know, I've been using Claude for research, I've been using it for coding projects, and the quality of it and the depth of understanding and the amount of errors it's been making has been, you know, improving exponentially, right? And I don't think it's long before you could do single prompt app creations, right? And it would be able to ideate, you know, iterate, create code, debug itself, you know, deploy, add product fixes, add new products, get user feedback, and you essentially wouldn't even need a middleman in that scenario. I did see one, you know, interesting post on Twitter that was basically making the case that although obviously this is great for, you know, small business people, like you said, you know, the entrepreneurial type, right? People with high agency, people who are working those desk jobs, who are working those spreadsheet, you know, the spreadsheet lackeys, like they generally don't think in that same way, right? They think in terms of security and stability, and they want to have, you know, a 9-to-5 that they go to. They have their defined job expectations, a defined set of routines and habits they and you know, work outputs they have to do, and then they want to go home. And this new environment is going to be, you know, pretty much anathema to that.
Yeah, a lot of that comes from the public school system. It's like people aren't, they're not taught to think for themselves or create for themselves. They're just taught to follow the system and obey the person at the top. So I need to find someone to tell me what to do. And it also excites me because it means that there is a better possibility that people will be forced to grow and forced to think for themselves more. You know, I'm homeschooling my kids and I want to give them that opportunity to think more for themselves and not just go to the authority and say, what do I do now? Tell me what to do. That's a huge issue in most Western countries these days, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, something I've been writing about, and Robert, I wanted to get your thoughts on this too, but you know, in this new world, right, it doesn't seem to me that, you know, investing in big tech or the Mag 7, especially when, you know, the Mag 7 are like 43% of all the responsible for 43% of all the growth in the S&P for the last 10 years. Doesn't seem like that's the play, right? Incumbent large software companies, even if you're into, you know, Tesla or, you know, NVIDIA or Microsoft or Google or Amazon, I think their moats are going to be eroded away extremely quickly. And the real play is going to start to become, right, the commodities bottlenecks. Because not only do we have, obviously, a commodity super cycle that's starting to form in gold, silver, you know, copper, basically all major commodities. But we also have this, what I could call like the reshoring or deglobalization narrative that's pulling, you know, not only obviously from the U.S., given our stance on tariffs under the Trump administration and, you know, more trade restrictions, but also globally. You know, COVID exposed so many issues with global supply chains, and it showed the importance of having some domestic manufacturing at home. I think that that trend, not only politically, but economically, is going to continue to play out. And so people who are investing in, you know, commodities, hard assets, right? Even like, you know, I've been having a lot of people talk to me in my DMs about uranium ETFs and uranium miners, given the, you know, the energy play with the data centers. You know, a lot of high base load, you know, high uptime energy is going to be needed, and nuclear and hydro are both perfect for that, for data center use. And so, those are, I think, the plays that need to be made. And obviously Bitcoin being the scarcest commodity of all is a great play as well.
Yeah. I haven't looked into individual names, you know, in a granular sort of way, but just to the point, I mean, you look at like antibiotics, we're 90-something% import reliant, vitamins also 90% import reliant, semiconductors 90% import reliant. We know what happened with PPE back during 2020. I was working in healthcare and I was, you know, it was impossible to source basic personal protective equipment. You know, you look at semiconductors as well. So rare earth minerals, all these things like that we have just completely kind of forgotten, you know, to adequately reshore. And look, it's a national security emergency, in my opinion. We have a net international investment position, negative 95% of GDP, which means effectively the U.S. has lost sovereignty, because if we do something the rest of the world doesn't like, they'll crash our bond market. They'll crash our equity market. And we're so hyper-financialized that that would crash our real economy. So, you know, there's clearly a need to reindustrialize and reshore. I've been saying, you know, I think we've reached peak globalization years ago. You know, I think the pendulum is starting to, you know, kind of swing in the other direction. That's going to cost so much money, like $10 trillion plus to adequately reshore and reindustrialize America. Now, whether or not we get a resurgence of manufacturing jobs, that's a different story, you know, and I think that even if we just reindustrialize from a national security perspective, where we're not reliant on our enemy to provide us the components necessary to build the weapons to defend our homeland, you know, even if there's no manufacturing jobs that come back, zero. I think that's still a win to reindustrialize. I think you have to. I think you have to do something to address the, you know, 3.5% of GDP current account deficit. I mean, I think it's untenable in terms of kind of the long-term prospects. So it's going to cost a lot of money. There's going to be a huge amount of CapEx and investment in those industries that have been forgotten, whether it be energy, which I think is only still, even with the bid into energy recently, I think it's still only like 3% of the S&P 500. So there's a lot of room to the upside, I think, with like energy, with mining, and you know, minerals and that sort of thing. So all of that, I think, is kind of the new frontier, at least for the U.S., because it was what was so forgotten for many years.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I was doing research for one of my silver pieces, and I came across, you know, some insane stats. Like the U.S., you know, although we have a large section of not only obviously oil and gas deposits, but, you know, critical mineral deposits, we have very few mines and we have next to no production. So, I mean, just for silver, for example, China controls like 75% of global silver ore refining. They produce like 98% of global solar wafers, 90% of solar cells, 85% of solar panels. They're responsible for a vast majority of refining in graphite, in palladium. And, you know, like, you know, elements like that are so, they're so bespoke, right? They're so unique that you don't really think about them. But whenever there's a, you know, complex electronics need and you need, you know, graphite or some, you know, germanium or palladium, especially for like, we'd talk about like missiles or, you know, laser technology that would go into, you know, low Earth orbit, China produces like 99% of that. And so if we ever get into a conflict with another nation state and we're relying on an antagonistic trade partner to supply us, that's a problem, right? That's not only obviously an economic issue, that's a national security issue. And so I think that's why the administration has been so forward with their moves towards, you know, naming silver a critical mineral, pushing, I think they pushed another 12 other elements onto the critical minerals list back in October. They've been working on, you know, expediting the permitting process for mines and for refineries, because it, you know, China has like a 30-year lead on us, and you know, if we're not careful, this is definitely a national security risk.
Yeah, and power generation too. If you look at power generation growth over the past 20 years in the U.S., it's basically flat. If you look at China, they're building a new power plant like every week. So it's like you mentioned, it's not for having a lack of resource. You know, I'm in SoCal, and out in the Salton Sea is the largest lithium deposit, I think, in the world, if not the Americas. And it's just totally untapped because of the regulatory burden that, you know, especially in California. I mean, it's already bad enough kind of U.S., on a national level, and you know, this administration's trying to you know, walk some of that back, which I think is good. But You know, it's way worse with California and the hurdles you have to go through here. I mean, it's kind of insane. But it's not for having a, you know, it's not that we are not resource rich, whether it be energy, whether it be minerals. We are one of the wealthiest, you know, territories of land in the entire world. The problem is that, you know, we kind of engaged in this neoliberal approach to trade and to industrial policy for so many decades, where we decide to make the dollar and the U.S. Treasury our primary export rather than, you know, anything actually useful, and ship all of our industrial capacity to the rest of the world. And look, that was very disinflationary. It was very good for the bond market, which, of course, is the means of financing for these bureaucrats and these politicians. So, you know, it makes kind of perfect sense why they did it. Also, by the way, as the trade deficit got larger, the current account deficit got larger, what that means mechanically, just on a double entry accounting basis, the accounting reality of a large current account deficit, about $1.2 trillion per year, means that $1.2 trillion per year of foreign capital is flowing into financial assets, whether that be real estate here in the U.S., U.S. treasuries, or U.S. equities. Well, who owns all the financial assets, you know, especially U.S. equities? It's the top 10% and the top 1%. So, you know, they kind of got very wealthy from the structural bid of about $1 trillion per year as a result of running ever larger trade deficits, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I would even, you know, obviously bring this back to the topic of the space, right? Jane Street. You look at some of the, you know, I was checking, you know, some other research on Jane Street yesterday. I found that their entry level role is base of $250,000 a year salary, right? Which is, that's competitive with an L3 or an L4 at one of the big, you know, L3, L4 software engineer at one of the big tech companies, right? And so not only obviously have we incentivized financialization on a nation state level, but also within our own economy, in terms of, you know, what people go to, you know, what they aspire to be, especially if they're an intelligent, ambitious young person. And that's kind of a shame, right? Because we're taking our smartest people who could be engineers, who could be, you know, software developers building apps or building the next, you know, AI tool or helping us to cure cancer or solve real world problems. And instead, they're just figuring out how to front run retail traders in Terra Luna, or they're figuring out, you know, the ways that they can manipulate the Indian stock market by buying futures and selling puts in the options market and then slamming the futures later in the day, like SEBI, the Indian regulator, was alleging, to profit a couple hundred million dollars a year, right? So not only do we have the, you know, the negative effects that you mentioned, the concentration of wealth and, you know, the deindustrialization of America, we also have the loss of economic growth from the people that would otherwise be working on productive things. You know, I think, you know, yeah, even though I worked in finance, I think you would agree with me that, like, having what it, I think our finance as a percent of our GDP is like 7%. And historically before 1900, it was like less than 3%. And having our smartest young people go work to build microwave towers so that Citadel can front run your order book by, you know, a tenth of a second. That's not conducive to society. That's not productive. That's not actually helping anybody. That's just figuring out how to do rent extraction at a more granular level.
Yeah. Like when my dad's generation was, you know, coming out of college, the smartest people of his generation were going to work at NASA, right? And we put a man on the moon, and, you know, putting the theories to the contrary aside, right? Like, we did amazing things.
Some Bitcoiners would tell you that that didn't happen.
Listen, I have my
doubts.
Yeah,
I know. Not to open that can of worms.
We'll just assume that we did that.
But go ahead. Sorry, Robert.
Yeah, no, look, financialization of the U.S. economy is a direct result of the dollar's reserve currency status. There's a phenomenon known as Dutch disease that is named after, obviously, the Netherlands. They discovered a huge deposit of natural gas off their shore And what ended up happening, you know, their economy was largely industrial and agricultural. Well, those sectors of the economy got hollowed out as all the labor, all the capital, all the investment went into this natural gas deposit and the energy sector. It ended up hollowing out the rest of, you know, basically what had been the core of their economy up until that point. And you kind of get a bit of a pendulum effect where there's an overinvestment, too much labor floods into that sector. That's exactly what has happened here in the U.S. with finance and financial services. The dollar, the strength, the overvaluation of the dollar, which is just kind of mechanical due to the way that international capital flows, that overvaluation of the dollar has made certain industries like finance, financial services, insurance, real estate, very, very lucrative. And instead of our brightest minds going to work at NASA, right, to build rockets, or, you know, to some engineering firm to build a new water treatment plant or a new bridge or a new airport that we need or a new fighter jet, whatever it may be. Instead of that, they're going to work for Jane Street to build a high frequency trading algorithm. And this is just kind of, I think it's reached its logical conclusion. And, you know, that gets to kind of the dollar, you know, and I think we're going to see a prolonged, you know, a post Plaza Accord sort of weakening of the dollar akin to the 1985, weakening. I mean, look, even if it's not to the degree of 1985 in the Plaza Accord, just go back and look at the dot-com bubble and the amount that the dollar weakened after that. So, yeah, I think that would be, you know, supportive, kind of all else being equal, that would be supportive of Bitcoin as well, and gold, of course.
And that would be, it would definitely be painful in the short term. But I mean, I see that ultimately as a good thing, because the dollar only has the power that it has because of the hegemony of the U.S., how it spread its tentacles over, you know, the whole world, and still to this day is trying to strangle that control. And now we have something like Bitcoin that can give us a way out of that system and maybe not see a horrible, you know, Rome ending catastrophe. Maybe there is a way that the world can grow positively from this and not just crash and burn, hopefully.
Yeah, it's short-term pain for long-term health, in my opinion. Like, we have tried in America to defy financial gravity for 50 years, maybe even longer, right? And so, you know, you can only defy financial gravity for so long. This is what Triffin's dilemma kind of gets at, right? Is eventually you get to this end stage where you have to make a choice between, with respect to Triffin's dilemma, you either choose your domestic needs or you choose your international obligation as a reserve currency issuer. I would argue we are already in that end stage, and that this administration is choosing to prioritize the domestic needs. Now, they haven't gone the full Myron playbook of, you know, taxing foreign capital, taxing U.S. Treasury interest, that sort of thing. They haven't really attacked the capital inflows yet. But I would say with the tariffs and the degree to which they aren't backing down on the tariffs, I think that they have chosen the domestic needs, which, look, it's good, but it's going to be painful. But there's no way to continue to defy financial gravity forever. The bill's coming due. We tried to kick the can, and I think we're kind of out of road on that can kick.
Yeah, exactly. You're basically giving away the entire thesis of my book, Infronomics. that's basically dollar endgame is Triffin's dilemma and the negative feedback loops that hollow out a reserve currency issuer and then eventually load them up with so much debt that they can't pay it off and have to, you know, default or devalue or inflate away. And of course, Triffin in his you know, original papers, if you read them, he was actually making the argument that we would enter systemic deflation. He thought that the world economy would essentially go through a Great Depression, something that would be systematic and global, because of our inability to issue enough dollars, because we were constrained by a gold standard. And, you know, like most economists, he had a lack of imagination for the government's ability to print money and to debase and to go back on their own word. Yeah. And to basically lie about, you know, their actual reserve holdings, which obviously led to, you know, Charles de Gaulle, and the French finance minister, Valérie D'Estaing, and I'm probably butchering that, calling the bluff on the dollar in the 1960s and starting to withdraw France's gold. And then other nations started to follow suit. And then we obviously had closing of the gold window in August 1971.
Didn't they send over gunboats to get their gold back?
Yeah, they did. They, I think France sent like one or two destroyers to the New York Harbor to demand payment. And that was in, I think, June of 68. And then obviously 3 years later, we closed the gold window. But the run on the gold market was pretty intense back then. You know, the U.S. saw their gold reserves dip by about 50% just within about a decade. And so
when it was even starting back in the 40s. That's a crazy thing that I learned recently is the dollar liabilities relative to gold holdings. That ratio started to already get out of whack in the 40s, which I thought was really interesting.
Wow. Yeah, that's insane. Well, that doesn't surprise me that much, right? Because we were fighting World War II.
Right.
And we'd only revalued the dollar via you know, gold to $35 an ounce. And I think that was in 33. That was after the executive order 6100, was it 6103, 6102 or whatever, the seizing of gold. So overall, like that's the end state that every reserve currency issuer faces, that dilemma, right? Do you fund, do you print enough dollars to fund the global economy to allow enough liquidity to flow so that trade can happen and foreign exchange reserves can be built and, you know, trade invoices can be settled, all that stuff? Or do you, you know, basically stay true to your domestic economy, to your monetary base, and refuse to fund all that and sacrifice, you know, your ability to be a reserve currency as a result? And so it's a hard question because there's no easy way out. Like Robert said, if we want to reindustrialize and reshore production, the unfortunate truth is that we're going to be giving up this free gravy train that we've been having for the last 20 or 30 years, right? This $1.2 trillion of positive cash inflow into the U.S. economy every year from foreign actors who are buying U.S. stocks, U.S. bonds, U.S. real estate, and propping up the price of everything, right? Contributing to essentially a massive bubble. You know, I saw yesterday, I think it was Joe Carlisari, you know, tweeted that foreign stocks are up like, you know, 20% or whatever in the last year. But the problem that the mistake he was making was valuing those foreign stocks in US dollars. And US dollars are down about 9.5% over the last 12 months. And moreover, like I said, if you take the MSCI World Stock Index and you overlay it with the S&P 500, the World Stock Index without the US has had about a fifth of the stock market gains that it has with the US. So the US is responsible for something like 80% of total stock market growth globally for the last 25 years. And so, you know, a large part of that, again, is this feedback loop. Is this the US, you know, offshores production, all these other countries start to produce goods, import them to the US. They all build up positive current accounts. They all don't know what to do with all this cash. So they buy US treasuries, US stocks, US bonds, US real estate, which props up US assets, and the cycle just keeps continuing. And so if we want to reverse this, again, we're going to see stock prices fall. You're going to see, you know, especially wealthy boomers, their wealth start to evaporate. You're going to see the wealthy be upset and angry that their portfolios are down. But the plus side will be, you know, reindustrialization of America and a reshoring of jobs and kind of a reemergence, right, of the blue collar rust belt middle class. But nothing will happen without pain, right? So either way you slice it, you know, someone's going to hurt. It's just a question of who's going to take the brunt of it.
Yeah, and it's a difficult situation if you want the best outcome. But that's the thing too, is I don't think most of the people at the top actually care about that as much as they care about if it's going to benefit them or not. Like they're not actually altruistic and trying to figure out how can we get out of this situation, you know, the best possible way. And unfortunately, we don't have much control over what they decide to do at the end of the day beyond just voting and hoping they do what they said they were going to do.
Yeah, because see, when there's another part to that flywheel, which is that as there is this foreign bid into equities, U.S. treasuries, real estate, by the way, just kind of for perspective here, just real estate purchases from foreigners over the past 15 or so years total up to about $800 billion, almost $1 trillion of, and that's just real estate. That's not equities or US treasuries. As that capital is flowing in back into US assets, you're not getting the corresponding amount of dollar weakness that our balance of payments indicates we should have, that are fundamentals, right? Currencies are can be valued on fundamentals. Ours is not, very few are nowadays, but that is how you get this kind of overvaluation of the dollar. The Dixie being at 95, you know, it might look like, oh, you know, we pulled back quite a bit from levels we were at a couple years ago. But if you look on a purchasing power parity basis, the dollar is even more overvalued today with the Dixie at 95 than it was back in 1985 with the Dixie at 162. And that's just on purchasing power parity. If you look at balance of payments, we run a 3.5% current account deficit and a 6% of GDP fiscal deficit. The dollar should be far, far, far weaker. And what's going to happen is, and we've already started to see it, the emergence of a neutral reserve asset. Right now it's gold, but eventually Bitcoin will benefit from some of these flows where instead of trade being balanced or recycled back into US financial assets, it'll be put into gold, and gold will act as the measuring stick against which currencies are actually valued relative to each other. That means, for example, a much weaker dollar relative to the yuan, or put another way, a stronger yuan relative to the dollar, because just as our currency has been overvalued, right, and gotten stronger and stronger, even as our twin deficits grow, the Chinese currency has actually gotten weaker and weaker and weaker over the past 25, 30 years, despite the fact that they run a huge, massive, historic 6.5% of GDP current account surplus. So what gold will act as is kind of the pivot point to revalue currencies. And eventually, you know, gold's benefited the most recently, but eventually Bitcoin will start to get some of those flows. I think you have to wait. You might have to have some patience, but I think eventually Bitcoin gets some of those flows. And I mean, we're talking like trillions of dollars per year in international trade. You know, so Bitcoin being a $2 trillion asset or $1.5 trillion, there is a significant amount of upside potential in Bitcoin if it benefits from some of those kind of neutral reserve asset flows.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, a lot of Bitcoiners have been messaging me, you know, kind of complaining, obviously, gold's rallying, silver's rallying, like, what the hell, why is Bitcoin flat? You know, some people even questioning their convictions, but I really recommend them to stay strong, because it's exactly what you said. What's happening right now in the precious metals market is simply a repricing of a commodity, right? Of an older form of money that has been essentially suppressed for decades. And one of the large reasons why the repricing is happening is because of the Shanghai Gold Exchange. This was a, you know, an institution founded in 2014 by the Chinese government, and it is one of the first spot settled physical only exchanges in the world. And so, in comparison to COMEX or LBMA, which are mostly cash settled and have a huge list of requirements for actual physical delivery, you can, as a retail trader, as an investor, as an arbitrager, you can go and buy futures or buy spot silver, and you can get delivery within a week, right? Which is a far cry from the weeks or the months that it takes to get delivery in the West. And so ever since, I would say, about 2023 in August, but especially accelerating 2024, a premium started to open up between the Shanghai price and the London and the COMEX spot prices. And so that created an arbitrage opportunity for traders to go and buy gold in the West at $30, $40, $50, $100 less, and then ship it over to Shanghai and sell it there. And as that trade grew, obviously we finally started to see upwards action on the physical gold and silver markets. And we've seen obviously this blow off top in silver from $80 to $120 just in January alone. And so I think that, you know, that concern about, you know, monetary debasement, the concern about financial stability, all that is flowing to the older assets first, just because of the structure of the system, because of you know, not only obviously, like I said, the Chinese element of, you know, the Shanghai premium over West, over the Western exchanges, but also because a large portion of wealth in any developed country is held and controlled by boomers, right? I think it's like 75% of total US household wealth is controlled by baby boomers. And by and large, they are not educated at all on Bitcoin. And so when they look at the array of options available to them, when bonds are, you know, not yielding that huge of a positive rate, especially if you compare it to inflation, when stocks seem overvalued and big tech seems to start to be trembling, right, as AI starts to eat up the moat and starts to attack margins, gold and silver seem like the logical step, right? They seem like the logical trade to hedge against inflation, you know, currency debasement and further economic chaos. So, but yeah, as time progresses, I think that that's going to change. I think people, especially as the boomers die off and all their wealth gets inherited by the zoomers, the millennials, I think the adoption curve of Bitcoin is going to start to accelerate, and we're going to start to see more and more inflows into this native asset.
Yeah, we're still very early, guys.
Yeah, I don't think people understand how quick it's going to happen too. Like, the governments are mostly run by the boomers, first of all, as well. So it's like they're starting to learn. I mean, my mom just bought her first Bitcoin. but as you said, yeah, they're going to be replaced by younger people that understand Bitcoin. But I mean, that's the thing, is like the settling, if you want the actual object, I mean, you can settle Bitcoin in 10 minutes. You know, it gold doesn't even compare at all. If governments are looking for a neutral currency to hold their value, once that domino starts going and there really is a run on Bitcoin, I don't think we've seen anything yet as far as what the price can do.
Oh yeah, we're very, very early. And yeah, it's unfortunate that, you know, we've seen so much manipulation, not only in the gold markets and silver markets, as has been alleged for years, right? I mean, on that Friday alone in late January, when silver was slammed from like $120 to like $74 an ounce, they dropped the equivalent of, I think it was like 600 million ounces of physical silver, which is equivalent to well over a year and a half of global silver production, you know, in a single trading session in an afternoon. And the people who drop those, you know, that amount of paper shorts, they never get called on their shorts. They never actually have to deliver the silver. Because if they were, they'd obviously would come up empty-handed, right? They don't have, nobody has that amount of silver. Nobody has a year and a half or 2 years of global silver mining production just on hand to deliver in the market. And unfortunately, I think what Caitlin Long says and what other people say about Bitcoin has somewhat come to pass, right? The proliferation of the ETFs, the proliferation of trading strategies and of options ETFs and of, you know, treasury companies and all these products, they've served to dilute Bitcoin, at least somewhat, right? Especially when we're talking about like retirement planners and day traders in terms of the equity markets. Those people might be more likely to actually just buy the paper-wrapped products like iBit rather than go and buy physical Bitcoin, you know, actually take it out to, you know, withdraw it to a cold wallet and store the seed phrase somewhere safe, right? They don't want to take that step of learning how Bitcoin works and how to self-custody. And instead, they'd rather just trade the actual derivatives. And it's unfortunate, right? Because that means that Bitcoin's price discovery gets impaired. And I don't think it's as impaired as gold and silver, because obviously delivery is so much easier. But it is somewhat impaired. I think that's true. And I saw a news report that BlackRock filed for an ETF to sell options covered calls on its own IBIT ETF. So they're going to create a yield income strategy ETF that's going to use IBIT options as a yield generator. And so again, that's another third order, fourth order derivative built on top of Bitcoin that is going to get money funneled into it that's looking for Bitcoin exposure, but not willing to actually just buy the actual Bitcoin and take self-custody. Okay, well, this was a great spaces. I don't really have much more I needed to touch on. But if you wanted to, Bitcoin Well or Robert, do you guys have any other things you wanted to touch on?
No, I mean, I would just say like my view specifically for Bitcoin for the next year, I guess, is I'm trying to stay unlevered. And I think if you're, as long as you're not using leverage, as long as you have conviction, and again, you know, I think that recently conviction has been tested. I've seen some kind of concerning posts from people talking about like their mental health is deteriorated to like the worst it's been, and they're anxious and they can't sleep and they're not able to interact with their loved ones. Like, if you're if that is happening to you, either I think you haven't done enough work and you don't have enough conviction, or your size is way too big and you're using too much leverage. So that's just kind of like the way I'm thinking about it. Of course, not financial advice. I would say, you know, expect volatility over the next couple months, over the next year. Expect volatility, but if you're unlevered and you're in spot Bitcoin, there's really nothing to worry about so long as you have low time preference and a time horizon, you know, call it 3, 4, 5 years and further out.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's with most markets, right? There's a fixation on the sticker price, right? On the number you see on the screens. But that number, although it does matter, obviously, for liquidity purposes, for just general market psychology purposes, it's not the true story of Bitcoin. Right. If you're fixated on number go up, and if you're fixated on just like trying to day trade it or swing trade or just make, as you know, little margins here and there on Bitcoin, I think you're here for the wrong reasons. Right. This is a completely new financial technology that exists separate from the incumbent fiat system. And if you know, want to take part, you can. It's easy. Anyone can go and buy Bitcoin and self-custody it and start using it day to day. You know, and adoption is, even though it's slow, it's still moving along, right? I saw that Lightning processed 4 times more transactions in 2025 than it did just a couple of years earlier. I just saw that one of my local coffee shops, they started accepting Lightning payments, which was pretty interesting here in Seattle. There's not a ton, but there's a few now. And so as that proliferates, right, as that grows, that's the story that we should be paying attention to, not just the sticker price that can be manipulated by Wall Street or can be, you know, shorted or arbitraged away.
Yeah, I just want to echo, you know, what Robert said about, yeah, don't leverage your Bitcoin, hold actual Bitcoin. Like you actually, I just realized you're both Roberts, Roberta, but Roberto also was saying, yes, that they're diluting. That they're diluting Bitcoin, and ultimately they can't dilute Bitcoin. They can only dilute the markets. And that's the thing, is it's never been easier to hold the actual asset. And no, not everyone's going to do it, but the more people that learn how important it is and how easy it is, it's much easier than dealing with physical gold. So, I mean, and that's our mission statement as a company as well, is we, unlike most exchanges, like, we don't hold your Bitcoin ever. There's no like question of, am I going to be able to get my funds out? Are we dealing in paper Bitcoin? When you send us money, we send Bitcoin directly to your wallet. So, I mean, that's our main focus as a company, is getting Bitcoin in people's hands, not holding paper Bitcoin, not doing leverage trading with Bitcoin. And like you said, yeah, just keep a long-term horizon and hold actual Bitcoin. And I think you're going to do way better than you possibly realize. So
I agree. I mean, again, I don't think it's bad, right? If you want to trade equities, if you want to trade derivatives, if you're a sophisticated investor, you know, and you want to try to use your intelligence, use your skills to try to get some premium, right, from the market, to try to get some alpha, go for it. But just be aware of your own experience and your own knowledge and your own risk tolerance, because if a position is keeping you up at night and in fact impacting your health, which that has happened for me, it's probably either too big or you don't understand the position, right? And so when it comes to things like, you know, IBID or like this new covered call option ETF that they're building, if you don't understand it, if you don't have a reason for owning it, then don't own it.
I that's a great point. I just want to make a mention. Bitcoin's long volatility, like being Bitcoin is a long volatility asset. The way that you're going to protect your wealth is from being long volatility. When you are selling covered calls, that is by definition short volatility. So look, there is a time where maybe I might, if I held IBIT, which I don't, but if I did, there might come a moment, but I've been trading options for, I don't know, 5 years, 6 years, and you know, have a little bit more understanding. Like, there might be a time where it makes sense to do that, but just remember all the people that told you to pile into MSTY, you know, what was that, like a year ago or so. If you don't understand, like Roberto said, if you don't understand derivatives and the way that volatility functions and options are priced and all that kind of thing, if you don't understand it, better to just stay away.
Yeah, completely agree. Awesome. Well, thanks guys for coming on. This was a really fun conversation. Really grateful that both of you could come up and chat and we could have this conversation. Everyone in the audience, please follow Infernomics and follow Bitcoin Well if you want more deep dive analysis on Bitcoin, but especially for Infernomics for macro and gold and silver. I use his videos actually pretty often as a resource to keep up to date on the repo markets, on plumbing, on gold and silver, on, you know, general macro trends. So I highly, highly recommend it. Thanks you guys for joining. This was great.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. And thank you, Infer.
Thank you.
Great.
Yeah. Great space, guys.
Awesome. I'll see you guys around.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Everyone have a great rest of your night. Enjoy your weekend.
See you, everybody.